Good morning. This is panel 5112. Here's how I defeat ISIS. It will start here at 9 and go to 10:20. We've been asked to finish promptly, so we will try to do so. Today is April 14th, 2017, and we're in the UMC Center Ballroom. I am Colonel Barry Bear, U.S. Army retired, and I will serve as the moderator for this panel. I served 26 and a half years on active duty, retiring as a full colonel. I'm a product of CU Army ROTC. I have a BS and an MBA from CU. And I've served around the world, including Germany, South Korea. I've commanded troops in Vietnam, Panama, if you remember that one, and the first Gulf conflicts. I've also attended the Command General Staff College and the Army War College. But I'm just moderating today. If you've not already done so, please turn off your cell phones and any other noise instruments. The panel members will speak for 8 to 10 minutes initially, and then we'll open up for questions. I need to read you this. In this CWA session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap Live Q&A, and then insert your question. As a reminder, it only has 250 characters for that question. You may also raise your hand at any time to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers. Then give your question to the producer, and if you are a student, please note this in your question, both in the app as well as the note card. Let me introduce the panel members, and they are seated in the order in which they will speak. First is Robert Kaufman. This is Professor Kaufman's 9th panel this week, and he has only 2 more to go this afternoon. So I believe many of you already know him, excuse me, and his background. He is the Robert and Catherine Dockson Professor of Public Policy at Pepperdine University School of Public Policy. He's a political scientist and prolific writer. Some recent articles, in addition to his many books, include What's a Reagan Internationalist to Do? Hillary Clinton Has an Actual Record of Mistakes and Bad Judgment in Foreign Policy, in defense of the Bush Doctrine. His latest book that's just been released is titled Dangerous Doctrine, How Obama's Strategy Weakened America. And finally, and as you will note as we talk about CU and many of our panelists, Dr. Kaufman will be the visiting professor on conservative thought and policy beginning in the fall here at CU. Our second speaker is Gregory Young, Commander, U.S. Navy, retired. Young grew up in an Army family, living half his first 18 years outside the U.S., particularly Turkey, Germany, and the United Kingdom. He was commissioned an ensign in the U.S. Navy from the University of Oregon Naval ROTC program. He went on to Navy flight training and for a majority of his career was a Navy pilot in key naval flight squadrons. But that is not what he is known for. While earning a master's degree at the Naval Postgraduate School, he received national recognition for his thesis research, which uncovered the mutiny on the Soviet destroyer Zhukov. This research was the basis for Tom Clancy's best-selling novel, The Hunt for the Red October. For the last 8 years of his Navy career, Commander Young taught political science at the Naval Academy and the Air Force Academy. He earned his PhD from the University of Colorado and is a professor of political science here at the university. Dr. Young is the author of The Last Century, the true story that inspired the hunt for the Red October. And for the last 10 years, his research focus has been Middle Eastern culture with a particular focus on Turkey, where he spent the last 5 summers doing research and teaching. Our third speaker is Lauren Fish. She is a research associate with the Defense Strategies and Assessment Program, and Future Warfare Initiative at the Center for a New American Society, based in Washington, D.C. She has Department of Defense experience, both as an intern, consultant, and employee. She is also, before doing that, was an HR consultant in California. She has a master's an MA from Georgetown University in international political relations, and finally is a University of Colorado graduate. Our last speaker is Maurizio Geri. Dr. Geri.
Jerry.
Jerry. Sorry. Jerry is a, this, sorry, he's, this is only his eighth panel of the week, and he only has one more panel to do this afternoon.
Italian style.
Now, I believe many of you also know him and his background. He's an international relations analyst with on-the-ground professional experience in Latin America, South Asia, and the Middle East. His recent papers include the treatment of the Kurdish minority in Turkey, and the evolution of political Islam in the Middle East and the democratization of processes of the Arab Spring. His current focus is on global democratic crisis and world order. Dr. Geri has a BA and MA from Florence, Italy, and a PhD from Old Dominion University. And so with that long introduction, let's turn it over to Dr. Kaufman.
Good morning. The United States has the capability to defeat ISIS and has to defeat ISIS because ISIS is an entity that is not deterrable. There is nothing we can do in terms of negotiating with an entity like ISIS or those who fight for ISIS. In order for deterrence to work, you have to have some incentive that appeals to the entity you're fighting if you want an alternative to fighting. When you think you're going to meet Allah for fighting against the West and get your 54 virgins, although depending upon the Arab translation, it's 54 grapes, and these people may be in for a rude surprise with a bowl of grapes rather than the 54 virgins. We have to defeat ISIS and literally annihilate their capability because there's no other way to do it. We have the capability to do it. It's going to require three things. First of all, where does ISIS get its money? It gets its money primarily from the oil refineries it controls in northern Iraq, Syria, that no man's land. We have to take that. Secondly, we have to isolate ISIS and deny its strategic mobility, primarily with American air power. We can do that. After doing that, we have to deal with the isolated ISIS entities with no longer the benefit of strategic mobility, almost a desert version of the what we did to the Japanese during the Second World War in the Pacific, destroying their strategic mobility with sea power and then taking the Japanese islands isolated after we did that. We can do that. Militarily, we can do it, although there's no substitute for active American participation, including boots on the ground. A coalition of the willing, where the United States, quote-unquote, leads from behind, will just prolong this conflict. You need a coalition, but a coalition that fits the mission of a decisive outcome rather than holding the coalition to the lowest common denominator of a weak consensus. Two things we cannot do. One, premature exit strategies. If you study warfare, the great analyst of war, Jeffrey Blaney, on page 3 on his Origins of War, concludes or prefaces his book with the conclusion, the most decisive periods of peace occur after the most decisive periods of war. You can't exit prematurely because if you do, Iraq demonstrates that, Libya demonstrates that, the United States leaving Europe prematurely after World War I demonstrates that, it is merely going to be an armed truce where the situation will likely recur. We underestimated the problem in Iraq, and we snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. We didn't think through the post-war phase of Libya, and we can't do that again if we're serious about truly defeating ISIS. Here's something else we can't do. Clausewitz tells us we should understand what the center of gravity is and know the primary enemy and be able to distinguish the primary from secondary enemies, the way Franklin Roosevelt and Churchill understood that Germany rather than Japan was the major enemy in World War II. If you beat Germany, Japan loses. If you beat Japan and didn't defeat Germany, you still lose. That means the one thing that we should not do, and we have been tempted to do, Obama did it to our detriment, Trump was tempted to do it to our detriment, is rely on Iran and Russia as partners in the fight against ISIS. As David Petraeus testified eloquently to Congress in 2015, as George Shultz and Henry Kissinger, two of our best secretaries of state, reiterated in the Wall Street Journal in September of 2015, it is strategically and morally confused to rely on the greatest threat to America's interests in the Middle East, Iran, to deal with a pernicious but lesser danger. It is well within the capabilities of the United States and a coalition of the willing, A, to defeat ISIS, and B, to create political circumstances where we settle something. But the worst thing we can do is succumb to the two temptations that President Obama succumbed to and President Trump seemed to be succumbing to until recent developments in a more positive direction. We cannot withdraw prematurely, and we must not rely on the greater danger of Putin and Iran to deal with the lesser danger of ISIS, because if we do so, we will make matters worse rather than better. That's too high a cost to pay. Thanks for your forbearance.
Dr. Young.
Good morning. I have a secret plan to defeat ISIS, so I'm not going to be sharing. I'm very happy to be here. About 7 of the last 10 years, I've been a moderator, like Colonel Baer. I was a bad moderator. I always got yelled at by the producer for talking too much. And I am very happy to say that one of the changes that made Conference on World Affairs Director the most hated man in Boulder, which he's a wonderful colleague, is to allow CU faculty members to be on panels. And so I am very happy to be here. And I am also happy to see large numbers of my students in the audience who I didn't make come. But I'm glad they're here. And to be on this august panel, and also one of my former students is right here on the panel. So I'm going to tell you two things. I'm going to kind of also tell you how to defeat ISIS, but in contrast to Professor Kaufman, I may tell you why we don't necessarily want to do it right now. We may want to necessarily have a more of a containment strategy, because there are two ISILs, ISIS, Daesh, out there. There is the territorial one that occupies large swaths of territory in Syria and in Iraq. And then there is the kind of existential or virtual ISIS. If you defeat the territorial ISIS, if you deny them the territory in Syria and Iraq, certainly you deny some of their ability to raise money from oil, as Professor Kaufman said. You deny their ability to organize attacks like occurred in Istanbul or in Paris or in Brussels. But I'm afraid that you can't bomb an ideology into submission, that the end of territorial ISIS will not stop the attacks in San Bernardino or Orlando or most recently in London, those that were inspired by ISIS rather than necessarily directed by ISIS. Happy Professor Kaufman talked Clausewitz, because I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of two grand strategies on war that go back to the Napoleonic era. Jomini was the idea that a war is a war is a war. If you defeat the enemy on the battlefield, then the political stuff will follow, that the center of mass of your enemy is their fielded forces, or in this case, the fighters of the territory. Clausewitz had a different idea of the center of mass. The center of mass is the people, and he often highlighted Napoleon's invasion of Russia, where Napoleon never lost a battle. The Russians never won a single battle, but they won the war, because Napoleon did not defeat the Russian people. And that same idea that to defeat the ideology is more than destroying ISIL's fielded forces and their ability to recruit overseas. How many of you watch Homeland? Okay. I get all my best counterterrorism advice from TV. Homeland is a very smart show. It's, you know, it's Israeli produced, and they know a lot about this sort of thing. Peter Quinn, my favorite CIA assassin, was briefing on last season about, he was asked how to defeat ISIS. So I immediately looked for him for advice. And he said, I need 200,000 boots on the ground. And there was kind of a pause. And then he said, I need an equal number of school teachers, doctors, and aid workers for a total of at least 400,000, which is similar to what General Shinseki said we needed in post-war Iraq, when Donald Rumsfeld said we only needed 135,000 lightning-quick, high-tech troops. You need to manage the post-war environment. But Syria is not Iraq. Secretary of Defense, retired Marine Corps General Mattis, I'm sure you heard this quote, when he heard about the cuts to USAID and the State Department, said, if you're cutting USAID and you're cutting the State Department, you need to buy me more bullets. That, again, back to Clausewitz, winning a war is not just defeating the army. Winning the war is a generational experience of restoring stability in these areas. And if you're going to defeat ISIS in that, you need to look at what are the causes of ISIS. There's a wonderful book by Joby Warrick, now a year old, called Black Flags on the Rise of ISIS. And yes, it's a year old now, but in terms of the causes of ISIS and ISIL, Daesh, it's still absolutely spot on. And there's an old saying, you know, that weeds grow in uncultivated soil. And clearly a cause of ISIS is the chaos in Syria and in Iraq. Now, Professor Kaufman and I will agree on that. It's nice. On Republicans and Democrats both agree that the United States is somewhat to cause for the chaos in Iraq. Republicans believe it's because we left early. Democrats believe it's because we went in the first place. So isn't it wonderful that we all agree? We can all sit down and agree that we're to blame, but for different reasons. The chaos in Iraq allowed Abu Masad Zarqawi, the Jordanian, who created this kind of use of violence to create sectarian violence on the ground in Iraq in the absence of good governance. I had Iraqi students who told me that the al-Maliki regime that was installed by elections in Iraq, sort of fair, certain people didn't participate, but those elections that put al-Maliki in that regime was even more brutal than the regime of Saddam Hussein, of Shia taking their revenge against Sunnis inside of Iraq. So the idea, clearly one of the causes, if we're going to, again, the 400,000 includes aid workers, doctors, we need to restore stability, not just defeat ISIS on the battlefield. And that takes maybe something the American strategic culture is unwilling to do very often. You could say we stayed in Germany and Japan for generations. They had different cultures, but still, the idea that you're willing to keep troops, aid workers. I mean, Bosnia, a combined EU, NATO, US effort put troops on the ground, but also put police trainers, put people on the ground to make the trains run on time, to pick up the garbage, to run the electrical grid, to teach the police how to do proper policing. I mean, war is not just defeating the enemy. It's very Clausewitzian, okay? So those bad governments on Iraqi side fueled that sectarian violence that Zarqawi was fomenting inside of Iraq. On Syria, the Arab Spring started in 2011, a little later in Syria than in Egypt and Tunisia. But Assad, the brutal regime of Bashar al-Assad, 15 students wrote you know, we must change the regime on the wall. They disappeared and had their fingernails pulled out. These kids were 14 and 15 years old. A million Syrians over a week came out in the streets and were met by tanks and snipers on the roof in Syria. This is not a nice regime. I would certainly not tell you that ISIS setting fire to Jordanian pilots in cages and is nice either. But remember that anything we do to defeat ISIS has a counter effect of helping Assad. Now, we've just recently seen Assad again, we believe, commit chemical attacks on his own people back to 2013. And the Obama administration believed they had done the right thing by getting Syria to sign on to the Chemical Weapons Convention, but we now know, obviously, that he maintained that either the ability to create them or maintain stocks of chemical weapons. I mean, ISIL, Daesh, is an incredible, brutal regime. I have traveled to Turkey last summer. I had the opportunity to work with a couple of refugee families. I mean, this is a refugee crisis out of Syria of absolutely epidemic proportions, only met by passing World War II, we say. But importantly, in Syria, the old maxim of the enemy of my enemy is supposed to be my friend. That's not true in Syria. And Thomas Friedman last week said, remember, Syria is not a knitting circle. I mean, it is not. There are complications on the ground. There are bad actors. Yesterday, the U.S. bombed, we believe, killed 18 fighters that are supporting us in our fight against IS with an errant bomb strike where we got bad coordinates from YPG, the Kurdish People's Protection Units, which, I don't know, intentionally or gave us bad coordinates. This is a very complex battlefield. And the idea that boots on the ground or airstrikes will be able to distinguish good guys from bad guys. I mean, right now, I do not want to aid Hezbollah, which, although now they participate in the government of Lebanon, they are a terrorist group. Assad's regime is a terrorist state regime. Do we want to aid Iran's continued support of Hezbollah? I think we want to continue to assist the Iraqi government in defeating Daesh, ISIL inside of Iraq. But I think a continued containment strategy, arming to some degree rebels, if you can figure out who friendly rebels are on the ground in Syria, because we don't want to create a thing where Assad can very easily resume control of that country.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Fish.
Thank you. So I will try to move towards more of a policy space because that's where my background has largely been. I have my master's from Georgetown. During that time, I spent 4 months at the Office of the Secretary of Defense working in the Middle East Policy Office, and then I also spent a year working for a member of Congress, a senator on the Armed Services Committee, covering the Middle East for him. So I think when we look at the problem of ISIS in Syria, it's very intimately connected to the problem of the Assad regime. As Professor Young just pointed out, that was really the genesis of where we see this group. And so we really need to be thinking about what comes next on both of those vectors. I think the worst possible scenario we could have would be a Gaddafi situation in Libya, where any actions that we took kind of spun out of control, there was mission creep, and then the brutal dictatorial leader of a country is found by rebels and extrajudiciously killed in leaving a country in chaos, where ISIS, as a reminder, also has a stronghold in Libya. So any sort of any ungoverned spaces that we leave as vulnerable are problematic for us to think about. And so with that in mind, we need to be looking at both the Assad regime and ISIS and ways to build governance, build areas of opportunity, while also fighting them on the military front. So this week's strike on the Ashraat airbase in the Idlib province in Syria, I think, was welcome. I think it returned a little bit of U.S. credibility and force to the negotiations in Syria. The Obama administration had been pursuing very heavily an agreement with Iran and Russia, which I agree with Dr. Kaufman that would be strategically problematic in the long term, but at the expense of not irritating them, trying to get a diplomatic negotiation. I think this week's strike, or last week's strike, I should say, indicated a return to a coercive diplomacy, if you will. You need to have some of those sticks along with the carrots. We undertook what is a just response. It was a proportional response to a horrific chemical weapons attack killing almost 100 people. We coordinated that, reports say, with the Russians, so there was no loss of life intended in the strike. It was meant to take out military capabilities of the Assad regime to carry out further attacks like this. I would say that Assad's use of the chemical weapons was in direct response to the U.S. Not operating, them feeling that they could be a bit flip, and they quickly learned the wrong way, that that was not going to be the case. And I think Russia and Iran are probably madder than anyone at this point at the Assad regime, because there's now a little bit of space. I don't think that we can separate Russia and Iran from their support of the Assad regime, but there's at least an opportunity for some coercive diplomacy to take place. So I think in terms of on the ground, the fight against ISIL, we see progress in Mosul. It's going slow. Urban combat tends to be deliberate in that manner, but all accounts are that it's proceeding apace. The setup for Raqqa is continuing. So where does that leave us with some next steps? I would argue that we're trying to find the Goldilocks, you know, the right choice of what's next. And that leaves you with a suite of options. You certainly want to be going after the finance and the propaganda of this type of group. You have to realize that ISIS is an ideology at its heart, that it's an amoeba-type organization in that way. Any pushes or pulls on any one part of the organization could lead to a lash out in other parts of the organization. Defeating them on the battlefield in Iraq and Syria will mean that fewer foreign terrorist fighters travel to that region and instead stay home to carry out attacks at home. We already saw the brutality that can come from ISIS fighters returning home, as in the Paris attacks in late 2015. So this type of inspired attack is not going to go away just by defeating them on the battlefield. So it is much larger than that. With that said, there are some options that you could think about accelerating the Mosul campaign and the Raqqa campaign by using some sort of short burst of U.S. troops. We already have over 3,000 troops, reports indicate, in Syria. And I think the Obama administration's concerns about putting boots on the ground, if you will, lost us an ability to have the coercive diplomatic effects that we wanted from deploying troops. So to explain that a little bit in my thought process, by saying that the U.S. will send 3,000 or so troops to a country is a pretty bold statement. Your adversaries, your competitors see that, and they have some sort of pause. By trickling those forces in, you lose that moment of opportunity where somebody steps back and says, wow, the U.S. is serious, that the Assad regime won't be allowed to use chemical weapons, or that ISIS won't be allowed to be throwing homosexual men off of the roofs of buildings, or, you know, burning people in cages. Both of these are brutal dictatorships that should be not in control of people. So using any sort of surge in forces with the goal of being able to get some sort of political outcome on the other end, returning to a coercive diplomacy, returning to a little bit of a might behind any sort of diplomatic negotiated transition. With that said, you might want to talk about what the Assad regime's exit could look like, moving Assad out of power. Like I said, you don't want a Gaddafi-type situation where the regime completely crumbles. That's going to lead to more chaos and more bloodshed. Some of my colleagues have written about six zones in Syria that are kind of controlled by six different groups. So I think that the U.S. could be there to help on the civilian side, building governance, allowing for security, allowing for safety, building those local connections between people that can rebuild what a governance society looks like when you're not in civil war on the other side, and then go after those zones of control that are controlled by the Assad regime and by ISIS. And then I just end by saying a couple of the risks of this. The U.S. has seen a lot of public support for the strikes last week. I think that's largely because they were proportional. They were in response to a clear action. I would be concerned about political will if we were to make a huge change in what our policy would be, both at home and internationally. When I think about accelerating the Mosul or Raqqa campaigns, I don't think that you need to be talking about tens of thousands of troops. Reports are that National Security Advisor McMaster is looking at some combination of troop surges, but these would be kind of smaller, maybe doubling what we have there now. A second risk would be the risk of escalation with Russia accidentally. After last week's strikes, which we did brief them on prior to, as reports indicate, they did pull out of a deconfliction line that makes sure that our pilots that are both in the air are talking about who's where and that there aren't accidents in the air. So that is certainly a risk that needs to be managed because that's a highly escalatory situation, especially if you're talking about increasing the number of troops. Now, to mitigate that risk, I would say that Russia very loudly left Syria about this time last year, claiming victory on the battlefield. So they have something to lose here. If they get back embroiled in a conflict, that is bad for them. So we do have a little bit of leverage in that regard. And then finally, I would say to the strategic questions of leaving Russia with increased air and naval bases in Syria, the Iran regime with increased access to Damascus through which they give weapons to Hezbollah in Lebanon through Damascus, and then more broadly about whether our forces are ready for the coming fights, staying focused solely on the Middle East, which isn't, in my view, an existential threat, the ISIS threat, at the expense of not being ready for a fight in 30 years, where if we're not taking the steps today to be modernizing our aircraft, keeping our forces ready, thinking about new types of warfare for what might happen in 3 decades, that'll be on us before we realize it, and we won't be in a position to deter or to win that type of conflict.
Thank you. And our last speaker.
Good morning. Very happy to be here, even if also Italians get tired after many panels, so I will talk shortly. I'm very happy also to be here because there are different points of view, and I think one of the most important things in these debates is to recreate the public sphere, the moderate space where different points of view can be faced, because the problem of democracies and populism in our countries, Western countries today, is that many times we polarize, we divide each other, and Republican cannot talk with Democrats, Liberal cannot talk with conservatives, so I'm very happy that we have different points of view here. And another thing I want to say is this. I come from Italy. You know, we are very expert about violent extremism, cults, and terrorist groups. It's called mafia. Now, we tried to bomb and to do ordinary war against mafia, but it didn't work. I've been working also in Mexico for a few years. You know that there is the drug war. It doesn't work. Drug war goes on and on and on. Until with mafia, we started to cut the political structure, the economic structures, and also the cultural support. We could not win against this criminal group. So I will tell you that there is nothing new under the sun, and also U.S. should have learned already before to bomb again ISIS from the past, because Al-Qaeda it's not been defeated, has been reborn with ISIS. So practically you are more or less in war since 16 years, since 9/11, there is this war against these so-called terrorist groups. And it doesn't work very much to use ordinary wars, as Craig already said and Lorenz said. So in the short term, obviously, you will have to deal with 3 points. Political elements, economic elements, and also military elements. But in the long term, I will suggest to do new strategies, and I will tell you what are my suggestions. So, at the short term, to defeat the economic structures, first of all, as Professor said earlier, Kaufman, the oil is very important, but there are also the weapons. Who is sending these guys the weapons? So we have to talk about the trade of weapons. It's coming from Saudi Arabia, it's coming from Turkey, they are coming from Western countries, we don't know. So this kind of international economic support we have to think about if we want to really defeat in the long term. The second thing is the political system, political structure. The directorate of these cults, of these groups. How can we try to block these cadres, we say in Italy, I don't know in English, I think the same term. This directorate that is leading and supporting on the ground the forces. And then we have to think about, the international support. Saudi Arabia has a very similar dogmatic system, a very similar structural system, ideological system of ISIS. When you think about Sharia law, the systems in which they treat the judgment of the crimes. So this Saudi Arabia system is legitimizing ISIS and other cults that support their societies through these systems. So I think that we have to think also in this way. Now, regarding the long term, besides the short term, I want to talk the long term. You know, during World War II, in the European Union, nobody thought about integration of European countries. Now, today we need leaders that have long visionary policies. We need grand bargains from Middle East. How come the regional powers, they cannot come together, Turkey, Egypt, supported by European Union and by the U.S., to do international conferences and think how to solve the local conflicts, for example, Syria and Iraq? I have been studying Kurdish movement for a long time, and obviously, since the First World War, Kurdish area didn't receive their own autonomous region. So we have to talk about the societies there, which kind of autonomous regions they want to create by themselves, more than meddling as international powers in the local situation. So European Union, United States can support, like U.S. help European Union with the Marshall Plan. Why today we don't think about the Marshall Plan for Middle East from European Union side? This is what we have to talk about. Another thing I want to say is that you cannot defeat these kind of groups unless we have an integration of migrants in Europe, or at least in the West, so-called West societies. You know, our migrants in Europe, sometimes they we call it assimilationism or multiculturalist systems. Both of them are failing, because assimilationism, the people doesn't feel integrated in the societies. Multiculturalism, they feel excluded also because they maintain their own identity, but they are external to the polity and to the societies. So today we have to rethink about the integration of migrants in our countries, because that's the reason why many of these migrants then they lose their own sense of belonging to a society, and then alienated and disenfranchised, they go towards these associations and these cults. And finally, another thing I want to say is that socially and culturally, this ideology is very, as I said, supported by local and Saudi Arabian, Middle Eastern visions, but there are Muslims in Asia that are proposing different ideas. I've been studying also Indonesia, working in Indonesia. They are doing a battle of ideas, what Islam should propose for the future political arena. And in Southeast Asia, they have millions of people participating in associations like Muhammadiyah, Nadlatul Ulama. They do social activities, educational activities. Their madrasa, they don't teach only religion, they teach all the topics. So how can we, from the Western society, support this kind of political Islam that is more moderate? In this way, I think we can defeat ISIS in the long term. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have a number of questions. I will tell you that. Oh, all right, so let's start with a simple one. This is from an undergraduate student in mechanical engineering. What are your opinions on the effects physically and psychologically that the recent use of the MOAB ordinance have had on ISIS? Was it simply a statement by the U.S.? And the floor is open.
So I'll go ahead and jump in. I actually have a colleague who was a ranger, and he was the JTAC, so that's the guy on the ground who calls in bombs, basically, when you're fighting. And so he actually got to run over and be on the news yesterday, so it was quite an exciting day for him. So the Moab bomb is a huge, huge bomb. It certainly has a lot of firepower. It's developed and designed to bust up these tunnels. So ISIS has a number of tunnels, and again, ISIS is also in Afghanistan, so they're all over the place. They have a number of tunnels that are hardened, and they've been able to propagate attacks against U.S. forces as well as Afghani coalition forces in Afghanistan, and this is on the border near Pakistan. And so with the strike, I believe it's about 18 ISIS members that were killed. There were no civilian casualties reported. And so hopefully that would be to take away a tactical capability of ISIS there to plan and wage attacks. I think it shows that there's some battlefield commanders who have this authority. So General Votel, the central command commander, gave this authority to General Nicholson, who's the commander on the ground in Afghanistan. I believe that was asked for last week, and so he was able to carry out the strike. A similar type of effect could have been carried out with a number of smaller bombs dropped all at the same time. It's just this is quite a statement. So
it's not an isolated statement. You can't understand the use of this buster bunker without understanding that it's connected to what President Trump did in Syria. Whether you agree with it or not, it's an integrated strategy to convey to our enemies that we mean business and that we will enforce agreements or punish people who kill our Navy SEALs or renege on their commitments, which were phantom anyway, not to use chemical weapons. So this is an integrated strategy by the Trump administration with a heavy imprint of General Mattis and the National Security Advisor, General McMaster. In your words, to inject a much heavier dose of coercive diplomacy in how we deal with Syria and ISIS and deter our enemies such as Iran in the Middle East.
Next question. This is from another student. As a political studies student and American, I would like to know the U.S. government's policy towards defeating, combating ISIS. Is there a source where I can learn about the current ISIS policy to either support or debate it?
That's a great question. So I think the administration is currently undergoing a review. That review was briefed to the White House, I believe, about 4 to 6 weeks ago. It's under negotiation discussion right now. They're basically bringing a lot of actors to the table who would have equities in this. So that goes through the interagency process, pulling in experts from the State Department, USAID, the Defense Department, of course, various actors who would have equities and interests and the ability to provide insight. It appears that General McMaster has been talking numbers with some people and talking about troops. This is all speculative at this point in terms of what that really means, if this is just a consideration. The military is constantly thinking about what would it take, what would it require of us, how would the logistics flow. So until we really see some statements, it's not clear, it's all speculation. But you can certainly see it being debated in the statements that people are making after some of these strikes. Secretary Tillerson was meeting with Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, last week, and so you could see some of the conversation about how they're tackling ISIS there. And then at some point, the administration will roll out a more clear statement of policy.
If you want the best preview for what the policy is toward ISIS in particular and toward the region in general, I highly recommend you Google James Mattis's talk on April 22nd at CSIS in Washington, D.C., where he laid out his vision of the Middle East with Iran ranking the number one threat. But it essentially provides a fairly reliable blueprint for what the Trump administration seems to be doing, not only in the Middle East, not only with ISIS in particular, but with regard to Russia and China. April 22nd, CSIS, then General Mattis, now Secretary of Defense.
Thank you. This is for everybody, and we'll start with Dr. Jerry on the end. Human beings seem to justify Holocaust as a means for eliminating those they fear. How can the U.S. government persuade Americans to pursue a Holocaust relative to Daesh? Will that approach be successful given the broader concerns of the Islamic society? Human beings seem to justify Holocaust as a means for eliminating those they fear. How can the U.S. government persuade Americans to pursue a Holocaust relative to ISIS? Will that approach be successful given the broader concerns of the Islamic society?
As I said, we have to listen to the people. You know, Renaissance came out in Florence because we put the human being at the centers. So when we talk about groups that think and have a different identity from us, we have to listen to their needs. And different needs doesn't mean that we cannot integrate among each other. In Europe, we are trying to do that gradually. We will have conflicts, social conflicts, for a long time because culture matters and differences can create conflicts. But this doesn't mean that we cannot integrate. And that's why we have to start to talk, instead of Holocaust, genocide, start to talk about convergence among populations in the world.
Yeah, I would say that our interest in defeating ISIS is less to do with maybe our fear of ISIS. I mean, I certainly think that's part of it, but I would argue a homicidal dictatorial regime that's brutally murdering the people that they purportedly govern. I had the opportunity to meet some of the young men who are part of Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently, which is a civilian activist journalist organization coming out of Raqqa who was reporting on the brutality of this regime at the risk of their own lives. I met them about 18 months ago. It's brutal. So this isn't just that we fear ISIS, but it's more that they're committing tragic humanitarian injustices against innocent populations.
As I mentioned, you can't bomb away an ideology, but this is not about Islam. Bashir al-Assad and his father Hafez al-Assad are Alawites. I mean, that is a kind of a sect of Shia Islam, but this is not about Islam. I mean, the brutality that Daesh is carrying out, you cannot find justification for that in the Hadith or in the Quran. And you can't, and because the Assad regime is not doing it in the name of Islam. This is brutal violence. And some sort of Holocaust, which obviously no one would advocate against Muslim people, wouldn't make this go away either. We know that. Now, I'm not advocating no military response, but the idea that you need a coordinated military, political, and economic response. Every time every American boots on the ground, there will be some positive outcomes of that, but the more American troops in the region, there are some people who believe that American troops in the region is justification for this jihad or struggle against the enemies of Islam. So, again, I'm not saying that we should not, but the idea is it needs to be a balance. And it's not about eradicating Islam anywhere. It's about eradicating brutal dictators, either non-state or state. And so nowhere in that do I see some sort of attack against the faith.
Aristotle says that the mark of prudence is to make reasonable distinctions. With all due respect, it's inappropriate to use the term Holocaust to describe an American response to an entity that crucifies, cuts off limbs, and brutalizes in a way that should shock any decent conscience. A Holocaust is a specific reference to the greatest crime of the 20th century, where Adolf Hitler's Nazi Germany exterminated more than 90% of Europe's Jews within 3.5 years. There's nothing like it, and to call American self-defense a Holocaust is confusing a term that should be reserved for a very special category of crime. I'm all for political solutions to conflicts, but I think we're getting it backwards. You can bomb an ideology, and you have to. That's why we and how we destroyed Nazi Germany. I heard a reference to the Marshall Plan, and that's right. But the Marshall Plan came after unconditional surrender, not during the war. Winston Churchill got it right. In war, resolution. In victory, magnanimity. In peace, goodwill. You have to win first, win decisively, and convince the other side the way we convinced Nazi Germany, the Imperial Japanese, that they were totally beaten and had no choice. Then is the time for magnanimity. Then is the time for politics. If you try to do politics and negotiate prematurely, fanatical entities such as ISIS, rogue regimes such as Iran, revisionist regimes such as Putin or the Chinese regime will interpret that as weakness.
Go ahead. Just to add what Robert Kaufman said about defeating Nazi Germany. One is
societies where people might become radicalized, and the U.S. and the U.K. both have policies that have had some successes and some failures in terms of trying to prevent radicalization and trying to counter radicalization, and people have already gone down that path. So you see that a little bit, and a lot of it is actually parallels to gang recruitment, actually. There's in Minnesota been some kind of gang rehabilitation type programs that have also been helpful in preventing people becoming radicalized.
Let me just echo what Lauren said, that there are some studies that Arab Americans, largely, we don't have necessarily separation by religion, but Arab Americans earn more per capita than the average American. But if you look at Muslims in Paris or in the slums outside of, they earn significantly more. So back to Professor Jerry's comment about integration and assimilation is a very important part. Economic development. Turks, you don't find Turks blowing themselves up. Have you noticed that? And largely because Turkey has a very strong middle class, and the economic development in Turkey has been significant. Turkey is 98% Sunni Muslim, yet you don't find them radicalized in the same way. The term jihad from the Quran means a struggle within oneself to find the true path of following the Prophet. It does not mean killing the enemies of Islam. This is largely a interpretation which has happened in the 20th century. And beyond. Actually, a scholar by the name of Said Qutb, who wrote a book called Milestones, which has been quoted heavily by Osama bin Laden. I tell my students the reason he became radicalized because he went to UNC. It's the smell alone produced the thing. But no. He wrote this book in the 50s when it was just after he returned from Greeley and Colorado Teachers College. But that book justified the use of the term jihad to those outside. But this is a minority of people of the faith who do that. And again, this is to kill the ideology. You have to mobilize moderate Islamic groups that will challenge these interpretations. Muslims are peace-loving, hard-working citizens of the world. But their ideology, certainly it's not the first time a religion has been hijacked for violence. So, yes, there is a way to appeal to the ideology, but cultural change takes generations.
Thank you. Who would you support to govern in a post-Assad Syria? And do you think the U.S. can actually bring about stability in Syria when regime change will definitely destabilize the country even more? Dr. Kaufman.
Well, regime change sometimes works, and sometimes it's a bridge too far. By the way, it's not just conservatives, but liberals like Dexter Filkins of the New York Times and the New Yorker, and Leon Panetta, Obama's own Secretary of Defense, who also criticized the premature withdrawal in Iraq for undermining the provisional victory. We can debate whether we should have gone in, but as Joe Biden put it in 2009, Iraq seems to be, after the surge worked, with levels of forces, by the way, closer to Rumsfeld's than Shinseki's, we withdrew prematurely, creating a power vacuum. As for Syria, here's the tragedy of it. The time to have intervened in Syria was earlier in 2012 or 13, when there was a plausible moderate alternative. We don't really have any good alternative now, but is Iran, ISIS, or Putin our enemy in the Middle East? The answer is yes. So whatever comes next, Assad has to go, ISIS has to go, and Iran can't be allowed to cross the nuclear threshold. And with all due respect in terms of Islam, yes, Islamic fascism is a distinct phenomenon, but the great historian Bernard Lewis will tell you that the tradition of jihad as an external doctrine of violence runs much deeper in Islam than John Esposito and others who think it's an anomaly. So I think we have a deeper problem in the Islamic world, including Erdogan in Turkey, who is heading in an ominously Islamist direction, but more for that later.
But Dr. Kaufman, who would you support?
I support Assad going. I support ISIS being defeated and choosing the lesser evil after those two unacceptable alternatives and Iran are kept off the table. I don't actually have an entity because there isn't one, but I know what is unacceptable. We've had 50 years of the Assad family, and it's like a second marriage, a triumph of hope over experience, or Einstein's definition of insanity. We can't work with Assad. ISIS can't be tolerated. and we have to find some alternative that is the lesser evil out of the rubble of this terrible sectarian civil war that has not only imperiled Middle Eastern security. If you oppose Brexit, Brexit wouldn't have happened, as a matter of high probability, had the Syrian refugee crisis not metastasized. Whether we like it or not, we can't isolate ourselves from the consequence of this conflict in Europe or the United States, so we better win it. No, it didn't, actually. And we didn't stay, ma'am. We left without thinking through what the post-war consequences should be. And that's something I warn, and I think all the panel agrees that you have to use force, but winning is not enough. You have to think through creating stable institutions, or it's just going to be a breeding ground for the return of terrorists.
Dr. Young.
Our best ally fighting ISIS has been the YPG, the Kurdish People's Protection Units, of course, which President Erdogan says is just the PKK. So the idea that if the YPG or even some other moderate group, here again, the enemy of my enemy is not my friend, Erdogan would never allow the YPG to even take a piece, the Rojava piece of northern Syria. I would caution against, though, again, my argument for containment is just that. We have no alternative. And in the absence of a regime, some sort of, I would argue, for an international benevolent dictatorship like was installed in Bosnia. That costs a lot of money and takes a lot of force. But there is no good alternative right now to rule Syria. And the last thing you want to do is, in a post-Civil War society, leave it up to the people. I mean, I'm sorry, ultimately you want a democracy, but immediately you want a benevolent dictatorship guided by the EU or by NATO or by the UN who's willing to stay and build economic stability and build institutions that have legitimacy among the people. So I'm sorry, I don't have an alternative within the state either.
Yeah. Dr. Jerry.
Yeah, I agree with Greg. And I want to say that Iran has been brought back to international community after 35 years by the EU with an agreement in which also US, China, and Russia participated. Iran is fighting against ISIS. Also, the Kurds are fighting against ISIS. Turkey is fighting against ISIS. Saudi Arabia, I'm not very sure. So I think that the regional powers will have to take a lead in the future solution of the Syrian conflict, more than external powers. We had already in Astana the conference, and Iran, Turkey, Russia, they suggested the system of autonomous regions, because this is also we have to talk about, not all economic development. We had to talk about the territorial division. You know, the Ottoman Empire was divided by colonies and by the divided empire of our powers with the so-called mono-ethnic nation states that are not adapted to the region, like the so-called Middle East, or we can call Southwest Asia. I study autonomous regions, and I think for Syria, autonomous regions will be a very useful solution. So I repeat, every part should be included. The problem is Turkey doesn't want the Kurds because of the Kurds in their own country. We don't want Iran because of this idea that Iran can be an enemy, while in reality we are trying to socialize with Iran, at least from European Union side, and bring it back to the international community step by step. So I think with the inclusiveness of the grand bargain that we want to do for the Middle East with an international conference sponsored by UN, inclusion of regional powers, first of all Egypt, Turkey, and Iran. And Saudi Arabia will have to deal with this internal dogmatic Wahhabist and extreme ideology that is legitimizing proto-state and cult groups like ISIS. But also Saudi Arabia, if wants to deal with this internal radicalization, I think also Saudi Arabia should be brought inside and to create an international conference with a grand bargain for the solution of the Syrian conflict. And I repeat, some support, economic support from European Union or United States, call it Marshall Plan, call it as you want, would be needed.
So I don't have a lot to add. I think it's a lot of it's been well covered here, but I would just point out there can be a distinction between regime change in the sense of Libya, for example, where that wasn't the goal when we went in. It became the goal by some actors on the ground, and it happened, and it was left without being considered. When Russia first entered the conflict in Syria, which made it much more complicated to resolve, as I believe it was Professor Kaufman indicated, there was discussion of a negotiated transfer of power of a different political entity, potentially still within the current Damascus, you know, ruling class, taking over and having Assad exit and go live in Russia or go, you know, and I think that's a better solution for everyone. And so we can have potentially a change of power without having the mess of it. That's the goal, at least.
One thing we do not agree on, Iran being a party to working with this. Iran, I repeat, James Mattis has laid it out, Kissinger, George Shultz has laid it out, is our number one enemy, and what people see as socializing Iran in Europe, the Trump administration, I think rightly, has concluded is a terrible nuclear deal that enables the worst behavior of the greatest threat in the region. There is nothing we can obtain from Iran worth the price. We can deal with ISIS without relying on the greater danger of Iran, which is on the cusp of crossing a nuclear threshold based on an agreement that has acted as Prozac to the gathering danger. We do not want Iran, the sponsor of Hezbollah, the sponsor of Assad, to have anything to do or pay any price to obtain the phantom of counterfeit Iranian cooperation. That would confuse the lesser evil for the greater one.
And I would also add on that, I think there isn't an opportunity for America to simply walk away at this point, which, you know, might kind of be desired at times by people, but Russia has now secured naval bases and air bases in Syria that they have now agreements with the Syrian government for the next 50 years. So they're on the Mediterranean at this point. So this is a huge geopolitical coup for Russia. Their entrance into Syria in 2015 really changed the nature of how our relations with the Middle East look. And they've deployed S-400 air defense systems to Iran, sold them to Iran, and then as well into Syria, which both neighbor places where we have significant numbers of American troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, respectively. And those air defense systems can really mess with and take down, you know, F-15s, F-16s, et cetera, not fifth-generation aircraft that we have flying in those conflicts and in those places where we're fighting ISIS. So it is quite convoluted of a situation, but geopolitically and strategically critical.
Yeah, we have different positions on Iran, but as I said, the deal has been done by many countries, not only United States, European Union, Russia, China. So someone can pull out of the deal, but doesn't mean that the deal doesn't have a life again. So what I'm saying is that Iran has a tradition, apart from the Ayatollah regime, has a tradition of democratic values since 100 years. If we study at Iran, and is one country that sooner or later will have to be included in the regional integration as a stable, apart the regime, I repeat, apart the current regime, as a stable country, because the one that facilitated and funded the chaos of Salafist extreme is another country, called it Saudi Arabia, with through the madrasas and all the rest of finances.
This Iranian regime is a tyranny that's dangerous. Go to Freedom House on a scale of 1 to 7. Iran rates as a 7, least free. There's no democratic value in this regime at all.
Not in this regime, but in the country and in the culture, yes. And that's what we have to appeal to.
Well, we're dealing with the regime, not the culture.
Yes, also the state and the nation in itself.
Let's take just a different tack. And I'm going to combine two questions that are sort of related. ISIS is not our problem. It is Europe's problem. Let's just get out. And the second part of that is, why is there not a more unilateral approach in fighting ISIS? Is Europe that fearful of reprisals by ISIS? Europe appears weak because of this. So on one hand, should we just let Europe take care of it? And if so, can they do it?
Yeah, return to isolationism would be perfect. Our oceans will protect us. There's nothing we need to worry about in this globalized world that we can just curl up and just wait for their missiles to increase in range to get to us. I mean, this is an existential threat, but it's a real threat and requires a multilateral response. I would tell you that the United States spends more on defense than the next seven countries, but that doesn't mean we should go it alone, regardless. This is an international problem. It is not just an American problem, but it is an American problem as well. But I would certainly argue for a coordinated response with Europe. Europe militarily certainly has some things that we cannot do. The way NATO is organized is it's divided. There's task organizations, and there's things within NATO that other countries do. But I would argue that what the European Union, they have political and economic skills that we do not have. So any approach to ISIS should be multilateral, whether it is military, economic, or political.
Europe is of vital interest to the United States, but Europe without the United States is inadequate to deal with threats, and we've had 100 years of history to prove that. Without the United States, Kaiser Wilhelm would have won World War I. Without the United States, Hitler would have won World War II. Without the United States, the Soviet Union would have won the Cold War. Without the United States, Europe will not succeed in resisting Putin or radical Islam. So although we have to cooperate with Europe, as Joseph Joffe, the great German scholar now at Harvard and Stanford, put it, the United States still has to operate as the world's default power in key regions. So American action, deterrence, and political and military power is necessary, if not sufficient, to deal with ISIS, Syria, Iran, add Putin and China to the list, too.
Dr. Gary.
As I said, yes, multilateral approach is very important. European Union, we are trying more to face with economic and political issues. In Italy, we didn't have attacks. Did you think about why? Well, there are not only because we have the Vatican or because we are more spiritual or whatever. We didn't meddle militarily so much with the Middle East as France or UK. So I'm thinking about to do a suggestion to my government through our associations that we have in Italy to propose from the European Union an international conference, also including Russia and possibly other regional powers, for a long-term solution. And obviously, as I said, U.S. has to stay supporting us, as been always, as Professor Kaufman said, and economic element will be very important for the future development of these countries.
Okay. Abdullah II has continually advised the U.S. that we must attack ISIS wherever they are and not pay attention to borders in MENA and Africa, adding that they are not real borders anyway. Please comment.
There are certain cases where you have to do that. You have to go into places that are called failed states where there's literally Habesian chaos, as in Thomas Hobbes, where there's no political structure, where things are nasty, solitary, brutish, and short. As to whether you do it in a specific circumstance depends on the gravity of the threat, or the availability of plausible alternatives. So Abdullah's categorical imperative that this is our primary mission, that's not right. But there may be circumstances, and even the Obama administration that I've deeply criticized for its weakness, believe that as well in places like Yemen or no man's lands in ungoverned places of Afghanistan. There are times when you have to hunt down terrorists in failed states. Go back to 9/11. The problem in Afghanistan was, among other things, there was not a political structure, and sometimes terrorists breed in those circumstances, such as the chaos in post-intervention Libya. So you have to have in your repertoire of options what Abdullah suggests, but it's not a categorical imperative that you do it. It depends on the circumstances and prudence. Right reason about right things to be done.
Dr. Gary.
Yes, yes. As you said, I agree in part because they can complement some other strategy, but they can also be very counterproductive because if we extend to other countries, more and more maybe civilian casualties we have, and that's the risk of more and more appealing for radicalization with these new threats.
Let me just add a peripheral about King Abdullah. King Abdullah, has a Western-educated wife, and he was educated in London. Bashar al-Assad has a Western-educated wife, and we had this idea that somehow or another that Western-educated people with beautiful Western-educated wives we can work with. And it appears that Abdullah actually, when the Arab Spring started, called Bashar al-Assad. Their kids had bonded over video games, and that he said, you know, all you have to do is, like, a little reform here would be wonderful. You know, we could do a couple of things, increase governance and local control, and you could put a stop to this thing that's going on in Syria. It's about good governance, where terrorists rise up in these vacant spaces. But Bashar al-Assad did not want to hear about good governance. He wanted to continue his mukhabarat, or secret police state, and again shoot innocent demonstrators with snipers and tanks. So a military response is often necessary. However, very often a good governance response early on, before there's a failed state, obviously, after maybe it's a different, but before there's a failed state, might be a better way to go.
Ms. Fish?
Sure. So Jordan is one of the U.S.'s closest allies in the region. I think that they're a strategically important ally and that they've been there kind of lockstep with us on the ISIS problem. Let's not forget that it was a Jordanian pilot who was put in a cage and burned by ISIS as a propaganda video. So it was after that meeting, which happened, I believe King Abdullah was in with Senator McCain, the chair of the Armed Services Committee, when that happened, and his staff pulled him out of the meeting to inform him. But they have been consistently a partner there and a part of the 68-nation counter-ISIL campaign, which the ministerial was a couple weeks ago in Washington, speaking of the multilateral approach. But I think Jordan has been one of the only countries in the region that has cared about this issue as much and as consistently as the U.S. has. The Saudi Arabia, the UAE are a little bit distracted in Yemen, kind of in their backyard. And so Jordan is somebody that we should continue building that relationship with. That's all.
Okay, so given that we are dealing with ISIS in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Iraq, among other places, do we need a congressional declaration of war on ISIS? If not, how do we get the American people to put the adequate number of boots on the ground?
So I'll tackle that given the Hill connection. So ISIS currently, the war is being prosecuted under the same AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force from 2001, that authorized the U.S. to go after the terrorist groups that perpetrated the attack on us as well as the countries that harbored them. So because ISIS is an outgrowth of AQI, which was an al-Qaeda franchise started by Zarqawi, that has been the justification for continuing those strikes, even though it is around the world at this point and around the region at the very least, they still fall under that same authorization at present.
Yeah, there's adequate legal authority to do that. People may not know it, but in our history, how many times do you think we've declared war when we've used force? We've used force abroad close to 300 times since the founding, and there have only been 5 declarations of war. And congressional authorization is typically considered adequate authority. The question is, as a matter of prudence, does ISIS rise to the type of threat and require the type of mobilization that requires an act of war? And that's a prudential judgment. I think not. I think the existing authority is sufficient. But whether a state decides to declare war in a circumstance like this, where there is congressional authorization, is a political judgment as to whether that president thinks we need a declaration of war to convey and sustain the requisite political will. I'd incline to know in a circumstance like this.
Since there are 4 minutes left, I'd like each of our panelists to take 1 minute to sum up their position. Starting with, we'll start at the back, Dr. Gary first.
Yes, as I said, economic development, political integration are the only future solutions for the ISIS or whatever cult radical group will appear in the future. As European Union, we want to support this process of Middle East integration, also with the integration of Russian visions. And this could be a way to solve also future conflicts in the region, temporarily, tactically, strategically, some chirurgic attacks on the political heads more than the cadre or the training camps, like yesterday the bomb attacking the training camp, I think would be more useful with some international investigation on how to find the heads of these groups and cut them as we did with the mafia in Italy.
So I think that the U.S. would be best positioned to be really strategic in thinking about the long term. So both the post-conflict scenario, how do we get to post-conflict, which is kind of the middle period, how do we build governance and build stability, as well as the long term and strategic consequences of who are existential threats, how do we be prepared for what comes after ISIS, whether it's also in the Middle East or outside the region, and then how do we go about decision making. I think returning to some sort of coercive diplomacy where we use force as a means to get back to conversation is useful. And I think we demonstrated that last week. I think it's Thomas Schelling, Arms and Influence, basically forcing your adversary to take that last step to escalation is the best possible position that we could be in to be getting to some negotiated solutions. And I think this morning the Atlantic article by noted Russia scholar Julia Yaffe, reporter, she basically argued that Russia right now is kind of on the back foot trying to figure out what the U.S. is doing. There's some space there for negotiation and diplomacy that wasn't there, that hasn't been there for a couple of years. And so taking advantage of that with an eye to the long term would be the most prudent step at this point.
Thank you. Dr. Young.
I wouldn't disagree with any of that, but let me just add on just a little bit. In the short term, I think we should continue to support the Iraqi government in defeating ISIL inside of Iraq. No more boots on the ground, maybe special forces, maybe forward air controllers, maybe some air support. But short term in Syria, we should continue to contain ISIS. Long term, we do not want to benefit Assad. We do not want to benefit the Russians. We do not want to benefit Hezbollah. Therefore, some sort of long-term negotiated transfer of power that involves an international benevolent dictatorship in Syria so we don't allow a failed state to replace the Assad regime. But again, not defeating ISIS immediately.
Dr. Kaufman.
We can and should defeat territorial ISIS as a necessary, if not sufficient, condition, while keeping our eye on the greater danger of a revolutionary, malevolent Iranian regime, its enabler, a rogue Putin regime, and we want to beat ISIS in a way that does not enable Iran, Russia, Hezbollah, Syria, or its surrogates. And by the way, part of any strategy dealing with ISIS should do what Senator McCain recommended in 2013, ground the Syrian Air Force once and for all, leveling the playing field.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank everybody and give them a nice round of applause.